91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Each day, 6,100 Americans reach age 65, yet 38% of those haven't saved for retirement. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. The average length of retirement is 18 years, and 36% of those retirees will solely depend on Social Security. We have a panel of experts on hand to discuss retirement 2016 style. It includes the head of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, Max Richtman, and Dr. Karen Holder of the Institute for Research on Poverty, also noted commentator and personal finance journalist Jane Bryant Quinn. Her new book is How to Make Your Money Last. That's next after NPR and regional news. And it's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Monday edition. Well, this hour is devoted to individual retirement. The average age of retirement is 63 years. That's trending upwards. 36% of those over 65 live chiefly on Social Security benefits, and 38% have saved nothing for retirement.
We begin our program with two experts in Social Security and Medicare. First, Mr. Max Richtman. He's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He's also a 16-year veteran staff director on Capitol Hill, a frequent media commentator and Huffington Post columnist, and he joins us from Sperryville, Virginia. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Also with us is University of Wisconsin Professor Emeritus Dr. Karen Holden. She's a faculty affiliate of the Institute for Research and Poverty and the Center for the Demography and Health of Aging. And Karen Holden joins us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks for being with us, Doctor.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure. So let me ask each of you this. We used to think of retirement as a time to look forward to freedom, traveling, pursuing new or old interests, and spending time with our families. What's changed? We'll start with you, Max Richtman.
Well, what's changed is the capacity to reach all of those wonderful goals. We've seen retirement income shrink, pensions, the defined benefit pensions virtually disappear, home values decrease, and Social Security, as good a program as it is not really enough to keep up with the increased cost of living for more seniors. So they're scraping by, barely getting by, and that's why our organization, the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, has made a commitment in the last year and a half to work towards expanding Social Security, to improving the minimum benefit, to having a more accurate measure of inflation so that the annual cost of living adjustment will keep up with the true cost of living for Social Security beneficiaries. This year, the COLA, and every senior knows what a COLA is zero, because those forces in Washington that determine and calculate what inflation has done and over the past year determined there's been no inflation. That's not exactly the way seniors see it. So it's really time to look at Social Security in terms of expanding it, improving the benefits, and having a methodology for making sure that the cost of living adjustment is accurate and keeps up with the true cost of living for a senior citizen.
And Dr. Holden?
Well, I would say that we certainly are challenged more in terms of retirement. I think our perspective has been affected by the generation of the 40s and the 60s, when indeed pensions were expanding and Social Security was well-financed. But I think what we are facing now is a challenge across the board in terms of income inequality, so that we have pensions cutting back which is, and Social Security is sharing in this whole concern about retirement. We've seen the reduction in benefits provided by employers. We've seen shifts from defined benefit plans, which did provide secure retirement throughout one's life, to defined contribution plans that people can pull out of during their lifetimes, which may have some benefit, but also then the cost in terms of retirement income reductions. And debating the role of Social Security in the federal budget, which in some ways is legitimate, because that's a major government role, is to secure everybody's well-being. I mean, secure those promises or the possibilities of saving for retirement. And so we are in a major discussion about income inequality and how do we make sure that people don't fall into worse circumstances after they retire.
Dr. Holden, how many on Social Security, and you've studied these kind of variables, how many on Social Security continue to work at least part-time, and what effect does that have on its benefits as related, say, to age?
Well, the average age of retirement is is 63, increasing slightly as both people realize the consequences of retiring early. People don't work well into their lifetime. So you see, yes, a high percentage of individuals working as they also receive Social Security between 63 and 66, and some until 66 or 67. But after that age, most of Social Security beneficiaries are receiving Social Security and retirement benefits, and very little bit of their income is coming from income. On average, about a third of income, I believe, it comes from earnings across all Social Security beneficiaries, but Social Security beneficiaries are tilted just because of people die over time towards relatively young people who can continue to work. But it's not a major source of income as you enter your 70s and 80s.
You've addressed the socioeconomic and racial discrepancies in age expectancy and health status. Can you tell us about those? Would that be you, Dr. Holden?
Well, on average, minorities are less to have lower life expectancy, and that's one of the issues about changing the age of retirement, raising the full age at which you can, the age at which you can receive full benefits from Social Security. But across the racial and ethnic spectrum, people retire because they are unable to continue to work. We still have people working in very physically demanding occupations. And so by raising the age of retirement, you reduce the benefits of those who probably need Social Security the most.
But isn't it more involved, instead of being a racial issue, but more in poverty?
Right.
That poor
right.
people it don't is. Live as long, whether black
right.
or white.
Right. Well, that's right. You're exactly right. And indeed, we are finding that life expectancy is actually falling among the very poor. And so that is a concern. That is one issue being raised by those who are more cautious about raising the age of full eligibility for retirement benefits, because we are seeing among the most needy life expectancy actually falling slightly over the last 10 years.
Which was, I found, surprising. Max Rickman, the presidential election is around the corner, and some candidates speak of getting rid of Social Security and Medicare. Others want to privatize it. Others want to cut benefits or do cost shifting. So what could happen, and how will it affect beneficiaries, and what can be done about that?
Well, that's all very true, but there are also a couple of candidates that are talking about expanding Social Security. They're not talking about cutting it, reducing benefits. Both Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton have talked about adding benefits to the Social Security program. Secretary Clinton particularly seems focused on improving benefits for women, widows, the poorest of seniors, Senator Sanders has supported for quite a few years legislation that would improve Social Security benefits, raise the minimum benefit, and the benefit for all beneficiaries across the board. So it's, but it is true that many of the candidates running for the Republican nomination have talked about reducing Social Security benefits. And what I find most disturbing is some of them have pledged not to cut Social Security, but they won't. They haven't responded yet to, for example, the previous discussion about raising the retirement age. Does a pledge not to cut Social Security include not supporting raising the retirement age? Because let's face it, raising the retirement age is a cut in Social Security. So I'm hoping that some of these candidates at the remainder of the debates, the town hall meetings, particularly the ones that will take place in Florida later on this year, the question will be focused more accurately on these specifics, not just the generalization. You know, I've talked to many, many candidates over the years, and everybody says, oh, I'm for Social Security, but that doesn't mean a whole lot unless you get into some specifics. So one of the things that we're involved with at the moment is a forum that is taking place on February 16th. It's called Seniors Decide. It is being sponsored by the Leadership Council of Aging Organizations. That's 72 groups, some of them very large, some of them smaller. But these groups combined represent about 72 million people. And we have sent out invitations to all the candidates asking them to appear on February 16th between 1 and 5 p.m. They can be in person at the facility at George Mason University in the suburbs of Washington, or they can be brought in by Skype. So, you know, I hope that many of them will respond and will be responsive to some of the specific questions about what they would do in particular with Social Security benefit formulas, the age, ways to bring additional revenue into the program to improve benefits. And I'm looking forward to that session. The Leadership Council of Aging Organizations is chaired this year by the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare.
We're speaking with Max Richtman. He is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Also, Dr. Karen Holden, professor emeritus of public affairs and consumer science, faculty affiliate, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the Institute for Research on Poverty. We will be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Max Richtman and also Dr. Karen Holden. We're talking about retirement. And a little bit later in our program, in a few minutes, in fact, we're going to be joining with a personal finance expert and author, Jane Bryant Quinn, to continue our discussion. Tell me, Dr. Karen Holden, what percentage of income should be saved by those planning retirement? Of course, there are the realities of the world, but in a better world, perhaps, or
well, God,
what should be striven for?
Right, it depends on how long you're going to work. I think people should be saving 10 to 15% of their income in some way. I think some people advocate higher percentages, but I think in reality, asking people to save more is very difficult. But I think if you're not covered by a pension plan, that is forced savings, and you, especially if you're among the small minority that is not covered by Social Security, then you should be saving more. But it's very discouraging to see that there are individuals who, a high percentage, about a third of individuals who have very, very small or no savings for retirement. And that includes all kinds of assets. You're not, those estimates are not just looking at explicit pension plans, but they are looking at their savings, their housing, things that can be sold and used for retirement savings. So it's a little disturbing how little we think about retirement, which shows the importance of Social Security, because there are individuals are challenged for savings. And especially when we have stock markets going up and down, it's very difficult for people to plan for retirement when they don't know what is going to be there when they retire.
Would you tell us, Max, about the MIRA and what it is and how it's different from a conventional Roth IRA and who should invest in it?
Well, the MIRA retirement accounts are now available. And it's a method for savings that can be accomplished through an employer, and really it's a variation of the IRA that really would in effect force you to save. I wanted to mention, I talked about the forum that we're holding February 16th. I failed to mention that anyone that's listening who's interested in actually participating and formulating a question can go. We have a separate website, www.seniorsdecide.org, and we already have individuals and groups from over 30 states that have signed on to watch or host a watch party. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, so again, is you mentioned the political season that we're in the heat of right now, and I think that there has been not enough focus on retirement security, particularly Social Security and Medicare, and I'm hoping that candidates can be forced to respond to specific questions, and the more people that participate and join on the website will be able to have coverage throughout the United States. I think that'll have an enormous impact on eliciting accurate information about candidates' positions.
Okay, and just getting back to the MIRA, the MIRA, who should sign up for that? Who's eligible and who should sign up for that?
Well, it's my understanding that anybody that is interested can sign up for the MIRA. I'm not sure about the process. I think Dr. Holden she may have more detailed information, but I think it's universally available.
Okay, Dr. Holden, mm-hmm. could you tell
well,
us?
Well, I don't know that much more, but yes, it is universally available. It's, again, for people who can afford to set aside and for whom there are tax advantages for setting aside income.
Well, we certainly want to thank both of you for appearing. Also, we may be able to answer that question a little better with personal finance expert and author Jane Bryant Quinn. She's going to be on our program next. We want to thank you, Max Richtman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And also thank you to Dr. Karen Holden, a faculty affiliate of the Institute for Research and Poverty and the Center for the Demography and Health of Aging.
And again, the website for signing up for that symposium is seniorsdecide.org for February 16th.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman.
And joining us now is personal finance expert, author and columnist Jane Bryant Quinn. She's written many books about money and how to best use it and is frequently seen on PBS and CBS News. Her latest book is How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. And she joins us on the phone from New York City. Welcome to you, Jane.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Let me ask you, I was reading your book, and it occurs to me, with today's volatile global economy, do the same rules apply? Because no matter how stable our economy may be here in America, or may not be, we're so affected by world events and world economies. So how does one address those shifts?
Do you know, I think that when you're preparing for retirement or when you're in retirement, the first thing that you should understand is your longevity. You know, if you're 55, 60, 65, you're going to live another 20 or 30 years. And with that in the background, then you can look back and say, well, over the past 20 or 30 years, has business grown in the United States? Has it grown globally? Do we have higher profits? Are stock prices up? And the answer to this question is yes. So the short-term view is I pick up the paper and, oh, my goodness, I got to change something. I have to sell. The world is a wreck. Well, first, anytime you pick up the paper, you can find something that will tell you the world is a wreck. And also, you can find some good news anytime you pick up the paper. I urge people who are retiring on the verge of to remember, to take a long view and remember they're going to live 20 or 30 years or more. We celebrated my mother's 100th birthday this year, and she's rapidly advancing on her 101st, so I'm very aware of longevity in America. And you just don't have to be that kind of concerned when you're a long-term investor. And if you have, you know, savings and that's appropriately divided between stock mutual funds and bond mutual funds and CDs, I just don't think you have to worry about the headlines. And in an election season, that's very hard to say, I know, because if somebody comes on and says we're on the edge of catastrophe and it's the end of the world, and you say, oh my goodness. But you should just wipe that off your mind. Just think about the history. Think about the strength of America. Think about global economy. We're going to be okay over the time frame you're looking at.
Jane Bryant Quinn, we're talking a lot about dollars and cents and retirement, but could you touch a little on the emotional side? Many of our listeners might be going through the emotional side of retirement, including the change of not going to work every day, financial fears, maybe being cooped up with a spouse.
And for so many people.
Cooped up. I want to investigate those words, cooped up.
Yeah, well, we won't go there. But for so many people, their identity is inextricably bound to their work.
That's true. And it's something that you need to plan for in advance. When you are leaving work full time, you know, you were a reporter, you were a teacher, you were a lawyer, you were something else, and that was always part of your identity. And when you step out of that world and you cash your last paycheck, you are heading toward the world of what I call engaged citizen, retired. And that is a new identity, but it's hard to get there. Now, some people step out of the workforce and they go into retirement and they've got plans and they're fine and they just get from one spot to the other pretty easily. But that's not most people. You spend a little time, especially if you were forced out of your job early for reasons of illness or because your company closed or something like that. You spend time thinking about who you were, who you used to be, and not enough time thinking about who you are going to become. I think this is going to turn out to be a very creative time, but it's hard to see it at first. I think of it as like being when you got out of high school or you got out of college and suddenly you think, who am I going to be and what am I going to latch on to and what kind of a life am I going to have? And you figure that out. But then all of a sudden, here you are at 60, 65, and you're not working anymore and that part of life is behind you. And the field is empty in front of you again. And you think, who am I going to be? What am I going to do for 20 or 30 years? And when you're planning retirement, that's one of the things you should think about, not only your financial future, but also your emotional future and how you get from one to the other. But then you have to be prepared, you know, after the honeymoon of, you know, I'm free, and then the question is free to do what? you have to be prepared for a little depression and a little searching around for a while before you sort of pull it together and find out what you're going to do for the next 20 or 30 years and right-size your life, as I call it, meaning, you know, get your budget and your income together so that your standard of living you can afford. It takes a while to do that, and I don't think people are totally prepared. You know, it's something that I'm facing myself. I am not going to work as hard as I worked for the last many decades. I'm going to cut back. But that means I have some time to spare, and what am I going to do with it? And, you know, I haven't answered that question for myself yet.
Mm. You know, in the book you talk about the five stages of retirement time management. Why don't you go over those quickly?
Okay, well, the first one is sort of preparing for retirement, and you might have some nerves about, you know, be a little nervous about what it is you're going to do, and you need to think about that. Then there's a honeymoon, you know, I'm free, isn't this wonderful? And you can sleep late and get up and have your cup of coffee, and then all of a sudden you say, well, now what? And then if that goes on too long, it can be followed by a period of depression. You might try to volunteer this, or you might try that, or you might get out on the golf course and then say, I've played 2 weeks of golf, I can't do this for the rest of my life. And so it's not unusual for depression to set in, and also the money may be going out a little faster than you expected, and that's another issue. So, but then there's a third stage, and that's when you face all of those things. You say, wait a minute, I'm not going to sit here in my chair. I've been watching television too long. And you start latching on to what you are going to do next. I mean, maybe you're going to drive for Uber. Maybe you're going to open your house for Airbnb.
That's
maybe
funny you should say that. I don't want to interrupt, but someone just gave me the New York Times today had an article on retirees, you know, driving for Lyft and Uber.
I'm not at all surprised to hear that. It's an easy thing to do, and it's one of the new part-time kinds of jobs that people, after they retire, discover to make a little money to add to whatever it is they're having now, and also, you know, to get out the door, to meet people, to do something interesting. If you don't have some other plans for starting a business or volunteer work you're deeply engaged in, or, I mean, this year you can go and work for a candidate. I mean, if you're part-timer, you want to get engaged in something political. So there is something at your fingertips in an election year. But you've got to, that's the third phase, basically, that you have to figure out. You've got to right-size your life. You've got to figure out what it is you're going to do for the next 20 or 30 years. And then you reach, you know, the last stage, which, you know, I just call stability. You've got you've set up your financial plan so that it's running. You're not worried about money anymore. When you get up in the morning, you know what you're going to do, and that, the whole purpose of getting into retirement and saving money for it is so that you can have a happy life for the 20 or 30 years after you retire, and you have to stop thinking about who you were. And I said it before. Think about who you are going to become. You are now an engaged citizen, retired. What does that mean to you, and how have you built a life around that? Can't sit in a chair for 30 years.
Well, now that we've addressed a little bit the emotional aspect of it, I'd like to get down to more of the basics that you recommend in your book. You talk about seeking out an advisor, but the elderly being targets for such fraudulent schemes, you say only fee-only advisors are the ones you favor. Who are they, and why should we get them?
Okay. When I talk about new retirees having a target on their backs, what I mean is, you know, if you have been in a retirement plan, an IRA or a 401k, 403b, you've been investing in a what I call a protected environment. Your company chose some reasonable mutual funds. You didn't have to think about it very much. Maybe you bought a target fund that sort of automatically allocated your savings for you, And then suddenly you retire and you are going to take the money out of that account and roll it into an individual retirement account, if that's what you decide. Everybody is standing right outside your door the minute you step out, offering to invest that money for you. And they are doing it because that, you know, you're where the money is. They want to sell you. There's a product called a deferred annuity, deferred variable annuity with lifetime benefits and maybe a couple of other names on it, which is a high commission product. Financial advisors love to sell that. High fees, 3.5% a year maybe, but it looks like a good deal. A lot of people buy that. A lot of people find themselves in the hands of advisors who buy other kinds of expensive investments. And so when you're looking for an advisor, when I say a fee-only advisor, I mean somebody who charges you up front for his or her time spent advising you, or charges you by the project, like drawing up a financial plan, or if you want somebody to manage your money for you, charges you for money management. You know in advance what the fee is, and fee-only advisors do not sell products that carry sales commissions. So the idea here, and it's a good idea, is that they're not conflicted. They're not going to give you something because it pays them a high commission. There are no commissions. And there's an organization. One is called the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, and NAPFA.org. And if you put in your zip code, they will give you, they're all fee-only advisors, and they will give you names of people who are in your area. You can check them on their websites. There's also something called the Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, Planning Network. Again, people who are fee-only advisors. So it's possible to find one. It's just very difficult because the easiest people to find are the ones who find you, who have products they want to sell you.
I want to get back to the annuities. You talked about these deferred variable annuities and how they're an expensive product, but you do like the single premium immediate pay annuity. So what's the difference between them?
The immediate pay annuity, I'll start with the ones that I call the black hat annuities, the bad guy annuities.
Okay.
There you put up some money. They're invested in mutual funds. You start drawing in 10 or 15 years. Because they're invested, there's a 5% minimum guarantee, and that looks great to you. And because it's invested partly in stock-owning mutual funds, you think you'll get even more and an even higher payment in future years. But that 5% minimum, first, the fees are so high you will never get more than the minimum. And second, that 5%, that's not a return on your investment. You get 5% of your own money back in increments over your lifetime. You have to outlive the use of your own money before you get anything out of this other than what you've put up. So I just think many people are misled and don't understand what they're getting with those expensive annuities. The kinds I like are called immediate annuities, and there it's very clear. You put up X amount of dollars. The insurance company will say, I will give you X amount for life or for the life of you and your spouse. Make sure you always cover your spouse. And that's it. It's neat, it's clean, it's low cost. You can go to a website called immediateannuities.com and put in your age and the amount you want to put up, and they will tell, and you'll get a list of insurance companies and how much they will pay you, and you can look at them and see who you want to do business with. And the immediate annuity, I think, is good for, you should not buy it if you're just on Social Security and have a small amount of savings, because you need your savings for flexibility. And if you have tons of money, you don't need it because you know your money is going to last for life. But if you're in the middle and you think you're okay, but you've been in retirement for maybe a period of time, you're not sure your money is going to last for life, because that's the scariest thing. Of course, you'll run out of money.
Right.
That is the time when you might be looking at immediate annuity. And if you have some money in a bond mutual fund, which many retired people do for the security. If you took part of the money that's in your bond mutual fund and you bought an immediate annuity with it, you would instantly get a higher income from that amount of money than you were getting from your bond fund. And it's very secure and it would last for life. And so that's the circumstance in which I would suggest you look at this immediate annuity.
How can you make a plan to, say, parcel out your savings over your retirement years? In other words, instead of scrimping and saving early on in retirement, only to find out that you really did that needlessly, you make your heirs very wealthy.
That's true. A lot of people do that. And part of the reason is, first, they're not so sure how much they can take. It's a question because you don't know how long you're going to live.
And you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if illness or adversity or...
Exactly. Am I going to need the money now? Am I going to live till 101? Do I stretch it out? I mean, these are questions that obviously cannot be answered instantly. But there are ways of doing it. But first, I want to say there are some people who have the idea that they should never touch capital. So they're living on interest and dividends, and it is scrimping their lives, as you just said. But if you've saved all this money, and the reason you saved it is to help pay your bills in older age, and so the idea that then somehow you should never touch it, you should, as you say, leave it all for your kids and just live off the interest, I don't think that's the right way of going about it. I'll tell you, I'm going to be happily dipping into capital.
You're going to live it up?
Yeah, why not? But there are recipes. This is one of the reasons I wrote this book, How to Make Your Money Last, because there are recipes. There's a lot of research that has been done over the past 10 years or so on how much you can afford to take out of your savings every year and be sure the money will last for 30 years. There's a range. 4% used to be the gold standard. If you take no more than 4% of your financial investments, stocks, bonds, CDs, plus an increment for inflation every year, that your money will last for 30 years, and that's true. Then it went up to 4.5%, because if you diversify your investments, you can really do that. And then there's a very good research that says as long as you're a little flexible about your spending, you can start by taking 5.5% out of your money and adding an increment every year. So you really sort of need to find out who you are, where you are, how you feel about investing, and then decide, you don't have to stick with that low 4%. You might be just the right person to take 5.5%, which is better. And then 10 years down the line, you look at where you are, and if you're doing really well, then you can take some more.
Of course, you have 101-year-old female genes on your side.
I am very aware of longevity. You can be sure of that. But I am also very happy to say that my mother is not going to run out of money.
Well, that's a good thing. Let's hope not, for your sake. She's been listening to you all these years. We're speaking with Jane Bryant Quinn. She's a personal finance expert, author, journalist. She's written How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. We'll be right back.
I wonder if Willie the Bee Man has his 401k in order there.
Well, we're speaking with Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert, author, journalist, written for Newsweek, Washington Post, and many other publications. She currently writes a personal finance column in the AARP Bulletin at AARP.com. Jane, we were just talking about Social Security with our guests before. You may have heard the end of our conversation, but you do talk about how to maximize the benefits, the latest news on that. Can you tell us what it is?
Right. First, as I'm sure your listeners know, that if you take Social Security at 62, which is the earliest age you can for retirement benefits, your benefit is going to be lopped by 25%. So, and that's for life. So that's a serious loss of money if you turn out to be longer lived. And also, if you take that and you're married and you have a dependent spouse and die, you have reduced the amount of income that your dependent spouse will be able to get. So, you know, this is a serious issue, especially for married couples. If you wait until 70, which I know many people can't because they can't afford to wait that long, but if you could, your difference that you would get between age 62 and age 70, just waiting those 8 years, the check would be 76% higher, plus inflation adjustments. So waiting is a really good idea if you can possibly do that. And some people can't. You know, if you're broke and you're out of a job and you just need to have the money, then you start at 62. But you might at least think, maybe I should take money out of savings for a couple of years so that I can have my Social Security check be a little larger. It's sort of a gamble. Some people think, well, I want to take it now because what if I died? If I died and hadn't started Social Security, I'd be rooked. I'd paid all those taxes. I wouldn't have gotten anything out of it. But you've sort of got two choices. You can say, well, maybe I'm going to live long life, or maybe I'm going to live a short life. And if you say, well, I want to take the money now just in case I die in 2 years, you're gambling on a short life. I think you should gamble on a longer life. People at 65, their life expectancies are to the late 80s, and in the past 3 decades, the number of 90-year-olds plus has tripled. So I think you should treat Social Security as a terrific longevity insurance program so that you will have a higher check over a longer life, rather than to say, well, I'm probably going to die young, so I'll take it right now.
Well, but what about, well, I have two questions. One is, we don't know the future for Social Security.
Nope, nobody knows the future. It's sort of gambling. Am I going to gamble that I will have a longer life, or am I going to gamble that I'll have a shorter life? You don't know.
But I'm saying, as, you know, with politics at play and a lot of different candidates talking about some increasing it, some ending it, some making it less, we don't know that either.
Do you know, I will bet with any listener that Social Security is not going to go away, and because you've got two groups of voters. First, you've got the older voters, and anybody who reduced their Social Security, you know, he's going to be looking for another seat or another job next year because they get voted out. And then you think about the people who are in their 40s, 50s, and whose parents are on Social Security. Well, if their parents didn't have Social Security, all of those people in their 40s and 50s would suddenly have to take their parents in. And of course, there would have to be a program for people who didn't have kids or whose kids, you know, couldn't afford to pay it. So they sort of think, well, we won't take Social Security away from younger people, we will from older period, but people. But then there's the next generation that says, wait a minute, you mean, you know, no way Ma is going to be able to save enough money to live to 101 or even to 80.
So there's politics, and then there's cash.
And so the politics, when people actually look at it and say, what will it mean if Social Security is taken away, or if Social Security is reduced so much, what will it mean to us socially in terms of families, in terms of how people can live in their older age, in terms of whether middle-aged people are suddenly going to have to financially help all of their parents who previously or otherwise would have been independent? Then you start saying, the politics of this, it's one thing to say, oh, well, you know, we've got this debt, we have to cut back on Social Security. It's quite another thing when people sit down and say, do I really want to do this? Is this what I want for my family, for my parents? I don't think so. So I am pretty confident that for all of the talk, first, it's going to be there. Second, I think it's entirely plausible that, you know, the top 1% or whatever will have their Social Security reduced, and because I think there would be political support for that, but I don't think that would create a lot of hardship.
Jane, some people say long-term health insurance is a must. Others say it's unwise. What do you say?
Well, I have long-term health insurance, but it depends on, and actually I will tell you a story about that. My late husband, who was quite a bit older than I was, by the time these products started being any good, because when they first came out, they were terrible. By the time they started being good, his health would not qualify him for it anymore. And so he had some very serious strokes, and it was extremely expensive, his care. However, fortunately, I was able to afford it, but, you know, no kidding around with the cost of that. And he died 10 years ago, and we had a lovely marriage. Then I met another man, and he wanted to get married. And I said to him, do you have health and long-term care insurance? And he said, no. And I said, that's a deal breaker. You got to go get long-term care insurance, which he did. So there's a kind of group in the middle. It's expensive, long-term care insurance, but you can cut its cost by such things as you don't have it cover you for life, you have it covered for 3 years, or you say, I'm going to wait 12 months before long-term care insurance kicks in and I'll pay for the first year. I mean, there are various ways you can bring it down. I think for married couples who are concerned of what would happen to the spouse at home if the other one went into a nursing home, and who need to look at that. If you absolutely can't afford the premiums because they are high, then you're in the group of people who will be able to get Medicaid when you go into a nursing home. I have some experience with that. My late mother-in-law, who lived with us for a while, and had dementia and eventually went into a nursing home. And she didn't have a lot of money, but it all went to the nursing home, of course. And then Medicaid stepped in, and nothing changed in her life. So because she had enough savings to pay for the first, mostly the first year, she could pay herself. And after that, she was in a good place, and Medicaid took good care of her. If you can't afford it, then you have a shot at getting decent help from Medicaid if you can't afford the insurance. If you're really rich, you don't need the insurance because you can pay for it yourself. But if you're in the middle, I would certainly look at long-term care insurance. And there are some companies, I know some companies, that the companies that charge you the least are the most apt to raise your premiums as you go along. But there are some companies that have never raised premiums on existing shareholders, on existing policyholders. I know one is Northwestern, one is New York Life. I offhand can't remember the third.
I think John Hancock is another.
Okay, so there. Thank you. That's helpful. So that's something that, you know, people can consider. What is their history of having raised premiums on existing shareholders?
Well, we've just about run out of time. We wish we had a little bit longer to speak to Jane Bryan Quinn. She is a personal finance expert, author, journalist, and she has a personal finance column in the AARP Bulletin at AARP.com. And her latest book is How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. I also wrote down DailyVoice.com. What is that, Jane?
I am now in the digital journalism world as well as in the print. My husband and I founded a online company for local news 5 years ago. It's in the New York suburban areas, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, because people are losing local newspapers. And we saw you can't be a community if you don't have a local newspaper and know what's going on. So we founded one online. It's quite exciting. I guess that's my second career, is being a digital journalist.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. And again, it's How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. Thank you, Jane Bryan Quinn.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Associate producer is Polly Landis. If you or someone else want to hear the program again, you can find free audio archives to download at our website, wlrn.org. Join us tomorrow for a South Florida history lesson. This one with longtime South Florida historian and author Arva Moore Parks. Her longtime project, the biography of Coral Gables creator George Merrick, is finished, and we'll learn about how his unique suburb and municipality came to fruition. Merrick's impact on South Florida life and history is immense. That's tomorrow on Topical Current. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.